Welcome to Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. I'm Norman Solomon. We hear a lot about the need to improve the lives of people in the United States and around the world. News coverage tells of progress in some countries and setbacks in others. But what is progress? What are the possibilities and choices for development, whether in Chicago or Cape Town, whether in Canada or Zimbabwe? Well, today on Making Contact, we're going to talk about such questions with two people who've been involved with development issues for decades. Kevin Danaher is co-founder of the Global Exchange Organization and editor of the book titled Corporations Are Going to Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream. Kevin, welcome to Making Contact.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Deborah Toler, Senior Research Analyst at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First. That organization is based in Oakland, California. Her article, called Secrets and Lies, Debunking the Myths About Africa, appears in the April 1998 issue of Essence magazine. Deborah, welcome here to Making Contact.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, President Clinton recently returned from a very highly publicized trip to Africa. Overall, I guess, pretty upbeat news coverage in the U.S. media during that trip. How typical is that, would you say, Deborah, of the usual coverage that U.S. media consumers get about Africa?
Well, it was refreshingly different. As I say in my article, the coverage on Africa is usually about death, disease, and disaster. So to the extent that people and a mass audience got to see the side of Africa that people like Kevin and I are more familiar with from our years of working there, it was fantastic. On the other hand, the concern that I have is that image was crafted with a particular message in mind, which was not that Africa in and of itself is an exciting, wonderful place to be and people are really doing wonderful things on the continent, but it was that Africa is a market for U.S. corporations, and that I found extremely problematic and troublesome.
Well, that market concept seems to be pretty widespread in the news media. You write in your article in the current Essence magazine, I'm quoting here, "Today, Western economic exploitation continues through unfair trade practices and enforcement of crushing debt burdens," unquote. I didn't hear much of that point of view in the coverage of Clinton's trip.
No. In fact, it was very interesting. If people had any access to listening to reporters or people from grassroots organizations in those countries, they continually brought up the disappointment that President Clinton didn't say anything about debt relief. At Food First, we actually call for debt forgiveness to write off the debts. But there was a continual level of expression of disappointment that he didn't bring that up at all. And certainly the trade regime that the United States would like to put on Africa is very onerous, it's very unfair. And the key example I would like to mention is that, for example, the United States is flooding African markets with U.S. subsidized, government subsidized food surpluses from our country. And at the same time, we're demanding that in order for African countries to gain access to U.S. markets, they remove subsidies for their farmers and that they remove price supports for their farmers. So the effect basically is for the United States to become the supplier of food for Africa and for African farmers to be driven out of business. So that's an example of what I meant by unfair trade practices.
Meanwhile, though, we're told that Africans can't feed themselves.
Yes, and that's one of the key myths that I take on in my article. The first thing that people need to understand is that right now, as of this moment, there's more than enough food produced to feed every man, woman, and child in Africa and in many instances to export. There is hunger in Africa, but that is a separate issue from the level of production in Africa. And the cause of hunger in Africa is the same as the cause for hunger for 30 million Americans, which is that people have inequitable access to economic and political power and resources. And the same obtains for the United States or Africa, but it is not an issue of food production.
One of the points you make in your article is that the issues that are at the root of a lot of the conflicts that do exist in Africa are similar to the issues around the world, and that is lack of equity, imbalance in power.
Exactly. One of the things that didn't happen in the media coverage very much is that they didn't get away from this term tribe. And what I talk about in the article is that tribe is a term, it's a colonial era term, which absolutely doesn't really have any meaning in terms of linguistic understandings on the continent. But when we use the term tribe, we then have an easy out for explaining the conflicts in Africa. Oh, it's this primitive, primordial hatreds that go back. But if you actually look at any one of the conflicts from Somalia to Rwanda, what we're talking about are people trying to grab power, trying to grab economic wealth or resources, or refusing to share political power. And in that sense, the conflicts are exactly the same causes, whether they're in Bosnia or Northern Ireland or the Basque in Spain or in different African countries. Those causes are fundamentally the same. They're political and they're economic and they're about injustices and inequalities.
Something that I think we rarely see in U.S. news coverage anyway is this question of the flow of money from Africa and to Africa. I mean, the image is that Western Europe and North America have been providing aid and kind of pouring resources, including big amounts of money, into the African continent. And yet, you've written about the flow of interest on loans that's coming out of Africa.
There's a net loss for African countries. That's never talked about. There is absolutely a net loss. If you compare the amounts of aid, investment, et cetera, and against the interest payments and the declining terms of trade that African countries, there is a net loss. It's an outflow of income and wealth.
And do you see any change in the public understanding in this country about the kind of flow of resources into Africa and out of it? I mean, do you see a shift in public understanding in the United States?
No, I don't, unfortunately. I just think that for many people, this whole concept of what debt and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and trade balances, et cetera, are fairly complicated, although they aren't really complicated for people that, you know, we can explain it in simplistic terms. But I think there's a resistance to understanding that in the case of Africa because there is this ingrained stereotype of Africans as quote-unquote beggars, whether you're talking about a famine situation or foreign aid or whatever. And so there's an ingrained sort of resistance to the notion that Africa could actually be transferring its wealth to the West.
Well, Kevin Danher, you also have been involved for a long time in dealing with issues that are directly related to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. As a matter of fact, you edited a book, which I have not mentioned yet, called 50 Years is Enough, The Case Against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Whether we're talking about Africa or Latin America or Asia, what are the roles that you see being played by these huge financial global institutions?
Yeah, at Global Exchange, we focus on educating people here in the United States because what we learned, I did my doctoral dissertation research in Africa, what we learned traveling around Africa, Asia, Latin America, is people would say to us, gee, it's really nice you come here and you want to help us. If you really want to help us, go back and change your society because it's your government, your corporations, and agencies like the IMF and the World Bank that your government in the United States dominates that are keeping repressive dictators in power in our countries. They say, look, if it weren't for the finance and the military assistance and all sorts of strengthening that comes from Washington and Wall Street, we could deal with our local dictators. But they are literally propped up by support from Washington and Wall Street. So your job as people in the United States is to change your society and democratize it. Think of this paradox. You go around the United States. This is the most powerful country ever on the face of the earth. You would assume that a country that is so globally powerful would have citizens that are knowledgeable about world affairs. And it's laughable. We're not knowledgeable about world affairs. The only way to understand that paradox is to understand that it is not in the interests of U.S. leaders and the U.S. officials who sit on the World Bank and IMF governing boards to have the population of the United States understand what's going on, because if the people of the United States understood what was going on, they'd rebel against it. It's immoral. It's wrong. And as Deborah pointed out, inequality in the world is getting worse, not better.
Just in the last few weeks, there's been a great deal of publicity about the situation in Indonesia. We've heard a lot of coverage about the so-called meltdown of Asian economies. And a lot of the spin is that, for instance, Mr. Suharto in Indonesia is basically part of a crony system, and that's why there's an economic problem in Indonesia. Do Do you buy that?
Well, it's very interesting to see the timing on this, right? When Suharto came to power on the back of a CIA coup in 1965 and 500,000 people were killed, there was no big problem with him. There was no screaming about a crisis in Indonesia or a dictatorship or crony capitalism. When he invaded East Timor illegally and killed 200,000 people there, there was no big outcry in the corporate press here about crony capitalism and the need to get rid of this dictator. It's when the financing gets threatened, when the profitability, when the money-making by the international bankers and financial casino gets threatened, then they start to question, well, maybe this isn't the best guy to be in power. So I think what we need to do is we need to get away from all this focus on the market, which is just money. Market rule means money rules, and the people with the most money are going to have the most power, to human values and meeting social needs. Are the workers in Indonesia who work for Nike, for example, are they able on that wage, that dollar a day, not an hour, but a dollar a day that Nike pays their workers in their factories in Indonesia, are they able to raise a family and afford running water and electricity and books and school uniforms for their kids? Or are they able, the wage that Nike pays in Vietnam doesn't even pay for three meals for the individual worker. It's so low. So we have to understand that these products that we're buying and that we're wearing and consuming are oftentimes based on unbelievable exploitation by people who are living under dictatorships. And those dictatorships are propped up by U.S. corporations and U.S. foreign policy. That means it's our responsibility to fix it.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Nike, a huge multi-billion-dollar corporation based in the United States. Time magazine, in their March 30th, 1998 issue, did a big spread on Nike. And I'd like to quote from it and get your comment, Kevin, especially since the organization you work for, Global Exchange, is mentioned in the piece. Time discusses the working conditions at Nike factories in Asia and then adds that another huge issue is the question of a fair wage. And the magazine goes on to note that Americans pay $100 for a pair of shoes that a worker gets $3 a day to make. And then the magazine quotes Kimberly Miyoshi of your organization, Global Exchange, saying that they pay Michael Jordan many millions of dollars a year to endorse Nike shoes. And then she poses the question, can't they find more money to pay the workers? And Time magazine responds in print, the answer is no. Corporations pay the going rate for labor wherever they are.
Well, the going rate, what is the going rate? The going rate a few hundred years ago in Africa was zero. It was slavery. It was guns and rum and some other commodities to tribal chiefs who would then go raid other people and sell them into slavery. And there was a multi-million dollar thriving global market in human beings. So where do we draw the line with this? If you, as a corporation, can go into a country that has a dictatorship that rules oppressively over its people, and you can get away with paying a dollar a day or $2 a day, does that make it right? No, I don't think that makes it right. Not if we believe that democracy and equality and people being able to feed their children is right. I have two daughters, and if they were threatened with hunger because of some political structure or some economic inequality, I'd be pretty fighting mad. And I think what we need to feel here in this society is a little bit of connection, a little bit of solidarity to those people who cannot feed their children. There is a child dying from the effects of hunger on average every 4.5 seconds in this global market economy. And it's because there's too many people who are poor. And one of the reasons why they're poor is because these companies will not pay a decent wage. So if you look at the development of any national economy, you got to a point where you got a demand for a minimum wage. Well, if we're going to have a global economy, let's have a global minimum wage, say $1,000 a year or something like that as a floor underneath people, whatever is a livable wage. And while we're at it, we could have a global maximum wage, say $1 million a year. Does anybody need to make more than $1 million a year?
I don't think Mr. Knight at Nike would appreciate that idea.
He's worth over $5 billion.
I'm wondering, getting back to looking at Africa, and Deborah, you lived in Africa for very long periods of time. You're a scholar of the continent's history. It seems quite often that people in the United States don't see the history as being very important. In other words, you'll hear stuff like, well, the colonial times, that was then and this is now. What does the history of Africa in this century have to do with the current circumstances?
Yes, that's a very important point, Norman. I think that people need to understand that, and I would like to point out there's a similar situation with African Americans and slavery, people say, oh, that was over a long time ago. You know, what does it matter now? In the case of Africa, both the fundamental economic structure of most African countries' economies, which is namely that they are absolutely dependent upon their ability to export in order to earn foreign exchange to buy just about everything they need, and the fact that they export primarily primary products, which are agricultural and mining resources, and the fact that the infrastructures of their countries were developed to facilitate getting those materials, raw materials out of Africa and to the West, primarily to Europe. That is a situation that began in colonialism and that has continued until today under what is currently the recolonization of Africa, because guess what? The World Bank says you all have to pay off this debt, and in order to do that, you need to export. So that's one. The structure of the economy has not changed, and that dependency on the West is still in place, and that goes back to colonialism. Politically, there's also a continuity. There's a continuity in the sense that the Europeans carved up Africa, irrespective of the way people had traditionally related to one another territorially, according to their ethnic groups and so on. And that put in place, and also the fact that the colonials, to rule, used the divide and conquer kind of strategy, in which almost in every single country they favor certain ethnic groups over other ethnic groups. And that's classic in the case, for example, of Rwanda, where they favored Tutsi over the Hutu. So that those kinds of group ethnic inequalities and differences were also in many instances put in place under colonialism, continued during the Cold War, in which case you had the United States and the former Soviet Union arming different sides. And so there's a legacy of that as well. And you cannot understand Africa's economic or political situation if you do not understand the changes that took place under colonialism.
That's the voice of Deborah Toler, senior research analyst at Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. Her article on myths about Africa appears in the April issue of Essence. Also with us is Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange and editor of the book Corporations Are Going to Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream, published by Common Courage Press. I'm Norman Solomon, and you're listening to the Making Contact radio program. We'll be returning to this discussion in a minute. If you'd like to receive free background information on the subject we're talking about today, or if you'd like to get in touch with the organizations mentioned on the program, Food First or Global Exchange, please call us toll-free at 800-529-5736 and give us your mailing address. You can call us anytime at that number, 800-529-5736. That number will be repeated at the end of this broadcast. We'd also like to let you know how you can get involved with this radio program, which is now heard each week on more than 100 radio stations in the United States, Canada, Haiti, and South Africa, as well as in other countries via the shortwave station Radio for Peace International. Let's resume our discussion with Deborah Toler and Kevin Danaher. Progress is something we hear a lot about. What is progress?
Well, the standard measure that's taught in development studies in college and that's used by our government and most of these corporations is a quantitative measure. How much stuff do you own? And that's true for individuals and for nations. You know, what's your gross national product? So if I go in a bar and I buy 10 beers, all that money contributes to the gross national product. If I go out and smash into a family and they're all maimed and need medical care for the rest of their lives, all of that expense is a positive contribution to GNP. It's a totally stupid measure. And if you look at the kind of thing they teach us as individuals to measure our success, it's how much stuff do you own? And I think what we're seeing is a struggle now to shift that. There are groups like Redefining Progress based here in San Francisco that say, look, we have to make a negative number. When you have to clean up a toxic waste dump, that's a negative number. Lung cancer from cigarettes, that's a negative number. Drunk driving accidents. And when you subtract those numbers from the U.S. GNP, you find out that the U.S. economy stopped growing in the early 1970s, and it's been stagnating for a quarter of a century now. And I think the same thing is going on with people around personal discovery and what is progress and development. It's not about how many things I own, it's what's the quality of the relationships I have with other human beings, and how diverse is that ring of family and friends that I have? How many people would cry if I die? Not how much stuff do I own? And that's what makes this an interesting time to be alive, is you got two different worldviews in contention now.
Is there a tension around definitions of progress in Africa?
Absolutely. And let me give an example from what our organization deals with, which is agriculture and food. Food production in Africa basically, the conventional wisdom of progress is that we need to increase production and that we need to do this using modern scientific means, namely green revolution technologies, pesticides, herbicides, biotechnology, etc. For the majority of rural Africans, food production and agriculture is not just about producing an item, stuff to eat or to sell. It is very much involved with kinship relationships, with community values, ritual purposes. There's a whole different worldview that's involved with that. In addition to that, the techniques that people use are techniques that are based on centuries-old knowledge and practices. We use the term agroecology to talk about these natural practices that are involved. They use composting. They use manures. They use ways of terracing that they were taught from years back, etc. Now, interestingly enough, if you want to focus on the issue of production, mass amounts, agroecology can match, and over the long term, it surpasses green revolution technologies. But what's more important is that people emphasize being in harmony with nature, and that's a very treasured value in the way that they produce food. So what they're being told is backwards and primitive is, in fact, what I would call the ultimate form of progress because it's interrelated with so many other important values.
Well, what about, I guess the question for both of you, about we keep hearing that there are barriers up to development, that the banking industry, for instance, is finding it difficult to move into these countries if they're based in Berlin or London or Paris or New York. They're having trouble setting up shop in so many third world countries, and those barriers need to come down. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, I think of the Asia crisis, because if you look at countries like South Korea, South Korea was doing fine as long as they had tight controls mm-hmm. over the capital market and the government was regulating exchanging the currency and money coming in and out of the country. Under pressure from the United States and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, they started to relax those controls and go more in a free market direction. And that's when the crisis hit them and their economy got destabilized. There's nothing wrong with the factories in Korea or the workers' education in Korea or the productivity. It was the finance markets. What you got to remember about these bankers and these financial speculators is all they care is about the percentage return on their investment. They don't want to get 9%. They want to get 15%. And they don't care if it's making napalm or baby bottles or whatever, guns, it could be anything. They're concerned about the return on the investment. So if there's not the possibility for them to extract more wealth than they put in, they're not going to go into an area. So this whole notion that was propagated by the Clinton administration with this recent legislation on Africa, this notion that, oh, if we could just get U.S. corporations to invest in Africa, everything would be fine, it's a bogus notion.
I absolutely agree. And in fact, one comment I'd like to make, Kevin was talking about dictators rule. I actually think, particularly in the case of Africa, that we've seen pretty much the end of dictatorships. They don't function, as Kevin said, in this new globalized capitalism. And I think their day is over. I think Daniel Arap Moi of Kenya and Sani Abacha of Nigeria are the last of a dying breed. What scares me more, quite frankly, is that this new generation of leaders that we have in Africa are what I would call technocrats, people who are deeply committed to alleviating poverty, people who are not corrupt, people who are not going to be gross human rights abusers, people who ultimately will have democratic systems, although they won't necessarily look exactly like the United States. But they honestly believe that this free market system holds the answer. And that, in my view, precisely because they are of such good intents to begin with, is the ultimate danger. And there's a whole young group of young African elites that are being trained, and, you know, go to school in the West, are being brought over literally in trade missions in reverse. They're brought over here and they're brought for workshops and special seminars, etc., and taught about the glories of the market system. And that, in my view, is in many ways going to be more insidious and more profoundly dangerous for the majority of people on the African continent than in many ways these, you know, brutal dictatorships that we could all immediately identify as the enemy and attack accordingly.
Because the embracing of the free market as the panacea is going to lead to, what would you say?
It's going to lead to gross inequality. It's going to lead to the situation we have in the United States, where you have a minority of people who are growing wealthier and wealthier, and the majority of us are getting poorer and poorer. And, of course, in Africa, we already have a very concentrated amount of wealth with masses of people very poor. So that situation is going to be even more exacerbated than we see in the United States. But my other concern is that those free market values and individualism and materialism can come to replace what I talked about in terms of people putting emphasis on community and kinship and spirituality and all of these other aspects that I think are very valuable about African cultures.
Well, you both work for active organizations that draw on a lot of scholarship and use research as well as activism to struggle for change in the United States and around the world. And in the couple of minutes we have remaining, I wanted to ask you each to let our listeners know, how can they telephone your organizations or their web pages or other ways that they can get in touch with you?
Food First is at 398 60th Street in Oakland, California. Our phone number is 510-654-4400. Our web page is www.foodfirst.org.
So anybody around the world listening could, for instance, go to the website www.foodfirst.org.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And there they'd be.
Our website is very similarly simple. It's www.globalexchange.org. And we have an 800 number. Call it anytime. Leave a message. Just leave your address. Say it clearly, and we'll send you out a packet of materials. It's 800-497-1994. That's 497-1994.
And people listening, if you didn't catch those numbers or information, you're going to hear the Making Contact 800 number in a few minutes at the end of the program. And if you want to get hold of Food First or Global Exchange and don't have the info to do so, please call us at that 800 number, toll free anywhere in North America, and we'd be glad to tell you exactly how to get hold of these two organizations. Overall, when you look at the immensity of institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, the huge multinational corporations, and then you look at the significant but relatively, shall we say, small budgets of your own group organizations, in 30 seconds or less, how would you describe how that makes you feel?
There's a saying in Africa that goes, when spiders unite, they can tie down a lion. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing democratization in a very profound sense of people saying, no, we not only need to democratize government, we need to democratize the economy as well. And that's spreading all over the planet now, the idea of grassroots popular democracy. And it will eventually come to power.
That's what I would have said, people power. It will do it.
Well, and here we've been speaking in the spirit of uniting a lot of spiders. This is the Making Contact radio program. And I've been speaking with Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange, also editor of Corporations Are Going to Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream, published by Common Courage Press. And also he edited another book called 50 Years is Enough, The Case Against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Also, Deborah Toler, senior research analyst at Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy, based in Oakland, California. Her article on myths about Africa appears in the April 1998 issue of Essence magazine. And look for her book, which is coming out later this year, book titled Africa, Myths and Reality. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
That's about it for this edition of Making Contact. If you'd like a transcript or tape of today's program or more information about Making Contact, please get something to write with. In a few moments, you'll be hearing our toll-free number, which can be used from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada. Making Contact is an independent production funded by individual contributors. Our producers are David Barsamian, Philip Babich, and Denise Grob. Our executive director is Peggy Law. To get in touch with our guests or to receive some free background information, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. You can also order tapes or transcripts by calling that same number, 800-529-5736. A special thanks to Seal Muller for engineering the program today. This is Norman Solomon. For everyone involved with Making Contact, bye for now.